People's Choice, Black Liberation Radio. We're in our 881st consecutive night of broadcasting, and it's indeed an honor to have on the telephones with us tonight, out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Brother James Cameron. And Brother James Cameron has done one of the most significant things in terms of reawakening the consciousness of the people that I think has been done in this country for quite some time. And what Brother has opened up is the Americas Holocaust Museum.
Black Holocaust.
America's Black Holocaust Museum. And Brother Cameron, welcome to Black Liberation Radio.
Thank you.
And I apologize for getting that wrong. We definitely got to get this right because everybody's got to come that way.
Yes.
Who is James Cameron? And can we get an idea of some things that happened in your past that give us an idea how you ended up doing this? I mean, this is a serious, had to involve a lot of serious work. And What was some of the motivation you think that might have moved you this direction?
Well, as a youth, 16 years old, I was in the clutches of a Ku Klux Klan mob. They lynched two of my buddies, and they were about to lynch me with a rope around my neck, and I was saved by a miracle. Mm-hmm. And I had to do 1 year in jail awaiting trial, and then I was sentenced to 2 to 21 years in the Indiana State Reformatory. And after 2 years in prison, I went up for parole, and they set me back 5 times before they gave me a parole. Mm-hmm. The first time, they set me back 30 days, then 60 days, then 90 days, mm-hmm. then 6 months, mm-hmm. then 1 year. Mm-hmm. And the sixth time I went up for parole, I thought they'd gone throw 2 years at me. Mm-hmm. But it's just lucky that new governor, Paul V. McNutt, had been elected governor of Indiana. Mm-hmm. And he removed all those old fogies off of the board of trustees who granted paroles. Mm-hmm. And he put his own men on.
When did this occur, the attempted lynching?
Oh, that was in August the 7th, 1930, in Marion, Indiana.
Marion, Indiana.
Yeah, that was a northern state, not a southern state.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you have to understand that D.C. Stevenson, the grand wizard of the Klan there in Indiana, he was a spellbinder when it came to spreading racial hatred.
Mm-hmm.
That guy became a millionaire in a couple of years by doing nothing but just selling robes, and he was getting $10 a piece for them, and everyone he sold, he kept $4 for himself.
Hmm.
Indiana at one time had over 500,000 Klansmen inside its borders.
Can we talk a little bit about the lynching? What attempted lynching? What led up to it? What were the circumstances? Brother Nomo X out of Columbus shared your story with us.
Yes.
And it was just an amazing story the way he told it. But could you kind of tell a story for us?
Well, I had been pitching horseshoe with a bunch of friends just the night before on August the 6th, 1930. Mm-hmm. And that night the moon was shining as bright as day. It was about 9 o'clock when the horseshoe pitching broke up. I was on my way home and a couple of my peers asked me did I want to go riding with them. And I told them I didn't mind it. So we got in the car. It was a little roadster. A 26 Ford Roadster with the rumble seat in the back. But the three of us sat in the front. Tommy was driving, Thomas Shipp, he was 18 years old, a friend of mine. We went to school together. And the other one was a fella named Abe Smith. And I sat in the middle between them. We drove out towards a place called Soldier's Home, and then over a place called the 38th Street Bridge. And we went to a place out in the woods along the banks of the Mississinewa River, a place called Lover's Lane. And on the way out there, my buddy suggested that we hold up somebody so we can get some money and probably buy a new car. And I wanted to get out of the car, but they wouldn't let me out. They kept on driving. And when they got out there, they got out of the car. We went through the woods, and I followed them like an idiot, very foolishly, through the heavy brush until we came upon a car. And as we were walking up to the car, I said to myself, anything could crawl out from under a rock and bite me or do anything, and here I am going around with these guys just like I'm tied to them. So one of the Abram reached into his bib overalls, on the inside of his bib overalls, and he said, here, Apples, you hold these people up. Now, the reason they called me Apples at that time, and I still answer to that name, although I'll be 78 years old in a couple of weeks, I used to bring apples to school and eat them at this old country school where I went to in Marion. And when the teacher would have his back turned to the class, putting some problem on the board, I'd sneak under my desk and take a big bite out of an apple. And one time I did it, and the kids started snickering and going on, telling on me on the sly, you know. And the teacher turned around and looked and caught me with my mouth full of apples. So he said, bring those apples up here, Apples. And from that day on, they called me Apples, even to this very day. Well, when Abe took this gun and told me to stick the people up, I said, what if those people in there have got a gun?
Good question.
I said, they might shoot back at me. He says, oh, no, they won't do it. I said, Tommy and I stand over here and make out like we got a gun, too. So, like an idiot, very foolishly, trying to keep up with my peers to show them that I'm just as game as they are, you know. It's got so many people in trouble that way.
Still today.
Yeah, right today it's still happening.
Got this country in trouble.
Girls go out on a date and with a double date sometime, and then one of them would say, I'll do it if you do it. Next thing you know, they're pregnant, and the guy's laughing at them for being such a damn fool.
Yeah.
So I took the gun. I walked up to the car. I opened the door, and I said, stick them up. Now, before I said stick them up, Abe had told me to put the gun on the people, and if they don't stick them up, shoot them. That was his words. So, like an idiot, I went up there and opened the car door, and I stuck the gun in the door and said, stick them up. And the man got out, this white man got out, and this white girl, her face was pale and lovely and beautiful and frightened.
That's beautiful.
Her boyfriend, this white fella, he was a friend of mine. He was a fellow who used to come down to the Interurban station where I used to have a shoe shine stand, and he wouldn't let anybody shine his shoes but me. Man, I was his shoe shine boy. So yeah, what happened? Like, whenever I'd be busy with customers, he'd always wait because he didn't want anybody to shine his shoes but Jimmy. So when I saw him, I said, holy smokes, I must be nuts doing something like this. So I turned around and I gave the gun to Tommy. And I told him, I said, here, you take this gun. I'm not going to have anything to do with you guys. And then I left. I started running down the dark country road. I had run, I guess, about 3 or 4 blocks when I heard some shots ring out. Bang, 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 just like that. Now, I might have been foolish, but I wasn't crazy as hell. I wasn't about to go back there and find out who was shooting who.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept on running until I got home. And then, when I got home, my mother was sitting up waiting for us because she never went to bed until all her children were in. And it was about 10 o'clock that night, August 6, 1930. And I looked like somebody had dipped me in the Lake Michigan and pulled me out. I was just wringing wet with sweat because I'd run about 6 miles on the way home from the scene of the crime that I had initiated foolishly, and that ultimately resulted in the death of my good white friend, and also resulted in the death of Tommy and Abe, my two peers, and damn near resulted in my death.
How did you get connected up to what went on? I guess Abe and them shot someone and eventually robbed him?
No, they didn't rob him.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't rape the girl, but the Ku Klux Klan said they did. You know, they always tell lies like that about black people raping white women.
Uh-huh. They didn't do nothing.
No. They left as soon as the shooting started.
Uh-huh. Who was doing the
farmers around there on a little knob overlooking the lover's lane.
Uh-huh.
They could see down there what was going on, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they swore up now that there was 3 boys doing the shooting. And another one said it was 4 boys doing it. They had everything all ass backwards.
But the brothers didn't shoot nobody, huh?
Yeah, the one of them must have shot him.
Uh-huh.
One of them must have shot this white fellow, this friend of mine. There's
uh-huh.
no doubt about that.
Uh-huh.
But Klan justice prevented the law from finding out which one of them did it.
Uh-huh. So you was at home and...
I come home. Uh-huh. And my mother says, son, what's the matter? Look at you. You're all wringing wet with sweat. I said, oh, Mom, nothing wrong. I said, I just... been over to old man Henderson's field playing football. I lied to her.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when I think about that lie today, I feel sorry for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't my speed. She hadn't brought me up to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, are you in some kind of trouble? I said, oh, no, I'm not in any kind of trouble. And I could tell her eyes boring into me. You know how mothers can look at a
mother
and tell when he's lying?
Mm-hmm.
She said, you go on upstairs and go to bed. I'll talk to you in the morning. And she fell down on her old creaking Davenport bed that she used in the front room, and I sauntered over to the stairway and staggered upstairs. Didn't walk upstairs, I staggered upstairs. And when I got up there, I pulled off my clothes and put on my old flour sack nightshirt that Mom had made from 100-pound bags of flour that we used to buy. And... I'm laying there in the bed trying to figure out what in the hell happened back there in Lover's Lane. Who was shooting who? And I said, I wonder if Tommy and Abe were still out there. Had they run home too? And all these thoughts was running through my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me like my veins wanted to jump out of my legs. You know, mm-hmm. I was just in a nervous wreck. And I'm up there pacing the floor and everything. Now, there were two little compartments upstairs next to my bedroom mm-hmm. where my two sisters, Marie and Della, were asleep. Mm-hmm. And I thank God that they didn't wake up that night. I'm laying there trying to go to sleep, and I can't go to sleep. All kinds of questions are buzzing around in my head. And about 2 o'clock that morning, I hear a rap on the door. Now, it was about 10 o'clock when I came home. Mm-hmm. So about 4 hours later, I heard a rap on the door, and I knew instantly it was the police. And if I could have willed my disappearance, I would have done so. But when I opened my eyes, I was still there. And I heard my mother get up off her couch and said, "Who is it?" And they said, "The police. Does James Cameron live here?" He said, "Yes." Said, "He's my son." I said, what's the matter? What has he done?" And they said, "Where is he?" He said, "He's upstairs in bed. Says he's asleep." And they marched on upstairs. Man, it sounded like a herd of cattle coming up the stairs. And I jumped back in the bed and pulled the sheet over my head, tried to make out like I was sleeping. I could feel the beams of their flashlight as they were raking my body with it, with the light beams, you know. Mm-hmm. And they snatched the cover off me and said, "Get up in there and put your clothes on." I got up, put my clothes on. I was trembling. And one of them said, "Have you told your mother what you and those boys did tonight?" I said, "I haven't done anything." He said, "Have you ever?" Said, "The hell you haven't." Said, you went out here with Abe and Tommy, and you killed a white man and raped a white woman." I said, "Oh, no, I don't know nothing about that." And they said, "Come on, the chief wants to see you." So I come downstairs. My mother's standing there in the doorway. I can see her now. We had an oil lamp. We didn't have electricity in the house. I can see her silhouetted against the doorway as she was pleading and wringing her hands and crying. Man, that woman went on something hysterical. She was asking God, "Have mercy, please help me. What has my boy done?" And then she was begging the police to take her instead of me. Mm-hmm. So I tried to be brave. I told her as they were rushing me out the door, I said, "Mom, I'll be back in a little while." Hell, it took me 5 years to get back. That was a long little while, man.
What happened once you left the house?
So what happened was, they took me down to the police station, and they were using a three-story residential building as a police building, you know. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a regular police station, just using a resident, three-story building, resident. Mm-hmm. And there was about 15 or 20 people out in front of the thing on the corner. The resident was on the corner of the street. Mm-hmm. And I wondered why they were there. That didn't pass my mind, nothing, didn't have any impression on me at all. But I found out later that they were there to get information for what had happened that night. And the thing that was most monstrous about the whole damn situation was the police had taken this man's bloody shirt and hung it on a flagpole extending from one of the windows of the police station so everybody could see it.
Mm-hmm. So they was like publicizing.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah.
You see, they have to understand, at that time, Indiana had, during that roaring 20s, they had over 500,000 Klansmen.
Yeah, that's big-time Klan country.
Yeah, that's what they had.
A little quiet. I think that's the Klan capital, in fact.
No, it wasn't the Klan capital. The Klan capital was Pulaski, Tennessee.
Oh, okay. I mean, not the capital, but the stronghold. You know what I mean?
Well, the stronghold. Yeah. They had more Klansmen in Indiana at that time than any state in the South.
And that's who picked you up some Klansmen, right?
Yeah. Well, see, the Roaring Twenties, they had over five million people inside the borders of the United States belonged to the Klan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Country.
So they got you to the station. What happened at the station?
Well, they asked me my name and address and where I live, and then they said the sheriff wants to see you. So the police turned me over to the sheriff, and I went in there, and he talked to me about 2 hours. And I told him just what had happened, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't hold back none. I told him I went with him, and they talked me into this, holding up this man, and then I left him because I didn't want to have anything to do with him. Mm-hmm. So the sheriff was writing all this down as I was telling him what happened. And then when he got through, he said, "If you didn't rape the woman, who did?" I said, "Hell, I don't know." And those cops in there, man, they beat me like I was a dog. Mm. And they made me get up off of the floor, and the sheriff said, sign this paper. Well, my mother had always told us kids, before you sign anything, always read it.
Mm-hmm.
And like an idiot, I reached over, you know, peered down, trying to read what the sheriff has written, and another cop knocked the hell out of me. Man, I saw a million stars.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the sheriff said, sign it, not read it. So with a trembling hand, I signed this so-called confession. It said that Abe shot the man and Tommy raped the woman.
Hmm.
So, 11 months later, that confession was repudiated.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had beaten it out of me, and it wasn't true in the first place.
Yeah. But they had already set it up, so they was going to get something out of this, right?
Yeah, they had it all set up, man.
Hanging homeboy's shirt out the window and stuff.
They take me over to the police station. I mean, from the police station over to the county jail.
Okay. Brother, let me say this for the listeners who might be just joining us. We're talking with Brother James Cameron. He is the founder of the Africa's Black Holocaust Museum up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And what Brother Cameron's doing right now, he's recounting to us an incident that he was involved in 1930 on August the 6th, where he was almost lynched. And the story he's telling us is leading up to the lynching attempt itself. So, again, brother, if you go ahead.
And again, brother, I remind you that my museum is America's Black Holocaust Museum.
Did I say that?
Oh, well, you said African.
Okay, America's.
America's, not America's.
America's.
America's Black Holocaust Museum.
Oh, okay, brother.
Yes.
My mistake.
So they take me over to the county jail and they turn me over to the sheriff. And what happened was this. You have to understand the jail was three stories tall.
Mm-hmm.
And they had cell blocks on each floor, each facing each other with a large corridor in between. You get the picture?
Yes, sir.
Now, on the first floor, they put Tommy in one wing and Abe across from him into the other wing on the first floor.
Mm-hmm.
Then they take me upstairs. They put me in the wing over Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the second floor, and there's 30 black train riders in there and four white guys in this cell block where I'm incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And when I walked in there, they all gathered around me and said, what's they got you for? What they booked you for and all that stuff, you know. I said, I don't know nothing about booking. I don't know what they done. They said, what they got you charged with? I said, I don't know. And then they said, what you in here for? And then they were so sympathetic and wanted to know. So I told them just what I told the sheriff. And they said, oh, Lord, said, I wish I was out of this here jail. There's going to be some shit going on around here. So what happened was, they kept on talking and playing cards called Dirty Hearts. And it was a game where you had to, if you caught with the Queen of Hearts, you were it or something like that. You know, I forgot what it was all about. But they played this game of Dirty Hearts all the time to pass the time away. So one of these blacks was sitting around talking just as if I wasn't there. You know what they were talking about? Me, just as if I wasn't there. Now they were saying, before this boy gets out of jail, if they don't send him to the electric chair, my son here will be a grandfather. Now there was another lad in there, 16 years old, who was the son of one of the train riders. See, that's why there was 30 blacks in there all together, 29 black men and this one 16-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I could have passed for brothers, same complexion, same size and everything, same age. So they sit around there talking about hell. Said, when I was a young man, I wanted to be a doctor, but it wouldn't do no good for me to be a doctor. Because down in Mississippi, all they let you work on is horses and niggers. And another one said, yeah, I said, I want to be a lawyer. Said, but any time the white folks get ready to put a nigger in jail, they put him in there and ain't nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all talking that kind of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't bother me at first, but they kept on talking and shaking the bars of the jail and looking out the window. And talking about different lynchings and things like that, how mobs treat black people. And finally, it began to dawn on me, and I became apprehensive in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I still didn't have any idea of what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Everybody else seemed to know, though.
Everybody else seemed to know.
Mm-hmm.
All of them were from the South, all those people.
Yeah.
Blacks in there.
Yeah.
And one white guy come up and put his arms around me and said, son, don't worry. I said, nothing like that ever happened here in Indiana. Says, that only happens down in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama. And when he got through, went back into the bullpen, I mean, went back into the cell block. See, they had a little bullpen that runs around the cell block where you could walk for exercise.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I was when he put his arms around me and told me not to worry. And as soon as he left, a black guy came up and told me, said, that guy's full of you-know-what.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I said, the sheriff might even be a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Might be in good standing, too.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what?
Mm.
Come to find out, the sheriff was a member of the Klan. I found that out after I got out of prison.
Mm.
But I went back to Marion, Indiana, and asked people about it, and found out a whole lot of stuff, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what happened was, they kept on talking. And finally somebody said, leave the boy alone, let him get some rest. So that was about, oh, I imagine, 7 o'clock when they got through talking to me. And I was weary, bone weary. They showed me a place that was my cell. And it had old striped tick on it, all kinds of stains on it and everything. And that was my bed I'd made for myself. So what happened was, I'm sitting there on the bed, crying my eyeballs out, feeling sorry for my mother and for myself, and wondering what in the world happened to Tommy and Abe. So while I'm laying there and sitting there trying to get some rest, somebody said, come and get it. It was breakfast time. Man, they had a big bucket of watery oatmeal there and some chicory coffee and some donuts would break your teeth on to eat them.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, I noticed some of the prisoners were giving theirs away to other prisoners because most of those prisoners in there were saying, man, don't it smell good this morning, you know. And they were accepting double portions and everything else they could get. But I didn't do so. I gave my portion to someone else. Then, about after breakfast, we started out around the bullpen, the circle around the cell block where you had the exercise space. And pretty soon, the guys was calling the other friends to the windows. And then pretty soon, all the games were broke up, all the card games. Everybody was staring out the window. And I went over there and I looked, and sure enough, the crowd was beginning to gather that morning at 8 o'clock. They had even broadcasted over the radio that there was going to be lynching down in Marion that night. People in Gary and South Bend, Indiana, eating breakfast that morning, heard about it, and they was unemployed. So they said, hell, let's drive down there and see what's going to happen. And they did. See, I talked to all those people. After I got out of prison. So what happened was the mob kept building, and about noon, the sheriff sent up and got me and took me downstairs, and there was a reporter there from the Marion Chronicle, and he wanted to question me. So he questioned me, and I told him the same thing I told the sheriff, and then he crowed at me. He said, man, if that guy dies, you're going to be in a hell of a lot of trouble. And he acted like he hated me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never seen the guy before. And the sheriff asked him, is the guy real seriously wounded? And the reporter said, yeah, he's all shot to hell. And sure enough, the guy died about 4 or 5 o'clock that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But before he died, after they took me back upstairs, I told the prisoners up there what had happened down there and how there was a reporter down there to question me about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, hell, they knew something was going to happen then, you know.
Yeah.
So wasn't any doubt in their minds.
Brother Cameron.
Yeah.
You said you found out later that they had announced on the radio that there was going to be a lynching in Marion that night?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Wow, that's heavy.
Sure. They announced it. Broadcast, man.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was they knew it was going to happen to men in the cell block where I was, especially the black men.
Mm-hmm.
And everything got quiet.
So it's the morning of August the 7th, 1930 now.
This is just about 7-8 hours after it happened.
Okay.
So what happened was the trustee, the black trustee, shuffled up there to the window and and gave a message to the one nearest the window that my mother had tried to see me three times, and the sheriff had said that I wasn't to get any visitors. Mm. And yet that son of a gun was letting white people come up there in droves to look through the window, you know, like they was on a sightseeing tour.
Uh-huh.
And they were looking through the porthole there into the cell block. And I wondered if they were doing the same thing to Abe and Tommy downstairs.
Had you seen the other two brothers since the...
No, I never got to see them,
Since Lover's Lane?
No.
And so, but they was having, white folks was coming in and getting peeks at you.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. We were a sideshow.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we were a sideshow. They were getting peeks at us. And I wondered how come they let them up and wouldn't let my mother come up to see me.
Uh-huh.
Then about 2 o'clock that afternoon, the mayor came up there.
The mayor?
Mayor Jack Edwards, Marion, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
He came up there, and he had a friend with him, a red-headed white guy. The man that got hair was red.
Mm-hmm.
This pink you used to keep rust from going on a piece of tin or something,
mm-hmm.
you know. That rust-oleum, or
yeah.
whatever they call it.
Real red.
Yeah, red. His hair was that red, man.
Yeah,
he had a handkerchief tied around the bottom half of his face, you know, so nobody could see him. And all I could see was those steely blue eyes looking at me.
Mm-hmm.
And he was gripping the bars there at the cell, of the cell block door, as Jack Edwards was questioning me.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Edwards was asking me, what's your name, where do you live, and who are your kinfolks and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he got to question me, he asked this friend of his, did he have anything to say? And he said, no, so let's get the hell out of here. But, man, I know what a hate stare is, because that guy was looking at me as if he wanted to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
So when that took place, there wasn't any doubt in any of the black men up there. And I wondered why the sheriff, why the mayor didn't hide his face, because my mother had taken me down to the armory when he was running for election, and everybody in town knew him, you know. He seemed to be a nice fellow and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had brought this masked man up to the jail to see me and talk to me, but he didn't want to talk to him. The mayor did the talking. So they went back downstairs, and the crowd kept getting bigger and bigger. The crowd kept getting bigger and bigger. You understand what I'm talking about, man?
Yes, sir.
And about 5 or 6 o'clock that afternoon, the streets was all blocked. A couple hours later, about 8 o'clock that night, I'm so tired and weary, I go back to my bunk and I sit there. I'm trying to get some rest. I haven't had a shut eye or nothing. And I'm catnapping.
Yes, sir.
Bowing my head and trying to stay awake. And one time I bowed my head, and next thing you know, somebody was shaking me and saying, get up, get up. They're throwing rocks at the jail. They're trying to break in. And I got up and ran down the cell block and out into the bullpen and looked out the window, and sure enough, there they were, man, 10,000 to 15,000 white folks out there. You know, I had never seen that many white people in all my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, living in a little town like Marion.
Yes, sir.
Only time we ever saw a big crowd of white folks was when Satchel Paige or the Kansas City Monarchs or the Homestead Grays or somebody like that, them black baseball teams.
Uh-huh.
When they come through, you know, to play ball,
uh-huh.
they'd rent a farmer's cow pasture and put up bleachers out there, you know, temporary bleachers,
uh-huh.
and charge the people 50 cents for a ball game.
Uh-huh.
And maybe 2,000 or 3,000 white people would come out and see the game along with the black folks.
Uh-huh.
And that's the biggest crowd of white folks I ever saw in my life. But when I looked out the window and saw all them white folks, man, I wondered where they came from.
Huh.
10,000 to 15,000 of them, the paper said.
What was they doing, man?
Yelling and screaming.
At the jail?
Turn them damn niggas over to us and all that kind of stuff. Man, he was cussing and calling on something awful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And,
when did you first hear them start to come into jail? Or when did you know they were coming in?
After they'd hung Tommy and Abe.
Oh, you watched that from inside?
No.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you're getting ahead of the story.
Okay, well, take me through it, brother.
Yeah. They came into the jail after the sheriff had let them in. But first, what they did, they took a sledgehammer and knocked the cement away from the door that was the entrance to the jail. It took them about an hour to knock away all the masonry around that door. So four men could grab it and just yank it out, see? Mm-hmm. And they pounded on that door for an hour until their hands began to drip blood.
Mm.
Because they were in such a frenzy to get into the jail, and the sheriff had come out and told them, go home, that man, that those boys are not in here. And they said, yes, they're in there, and said, we know they're in there. And the sheriff said, if they are in here, he says, I'm going to protect them, says, go on home.
Mm.
So what happened was, somebody said, get a sledgehammer. They got their sledgehammer, and they beat all around that door until their hands started bleeding. Because those fever, those blisters they form, you know, broke
mm-hmm,
open,
mm-hmm.
The blood started running out of their hands. Mm-hmm. And when they snatched that door out, the jail was theirs. They went into the jail, and they got Tommy out first, and hung him on the jail window on the cell block that Abe was in. Now, Abe probably saw him hanging Tommy from the jail window. And then he went back in, got Abe, and hung him on the tree up on the courthouse square. Then they came back, these 16, 17-year-old white boys came back and took Tommy down from the jail window and drug him through the streets like a dead horse and hung him alongside of Abe. And that picture that you see of those two people hanging on that tree, that's one of the most famous lynching pictures in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time they show a document on violence about the Klan, they always show that picture. And that mob meant for me to be hanging right there between the two of them. They came back up to get me, and the black man said, that boy ain't in here, Mr. Sionis, he ain't. And the white guys agreed with him. Those four white guys in there, they said, he ain't in here. So we don't know nobody named James Cameron. So they came over and asked this other 16-year-old boy what his name was, and he said, my name was Charles Haynes. And they asked me what my name was, and I said, my name is Henry Burton. I wasn't about to tell them my name was James Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was, while they were talking to me, the sheriff came up. He was a two-gun man.
Mm-hmm.
He had one gun in his hand hanging down by his side, and he was sweating so as if somebody had opened up a hydrant in the top of his head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was sweating profusely, just dripping off of him like water.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, come on, let's get the hell out of here. He said, you done hung two of them. That ought to be enough. So you ought to be satisfied now. And then he said, Cameron ain't in there anyway. He said, come on, let's get out of here. So the mob went back downstairs, and they told the mob Cameron wasn't in there. And they said, yes, he is. They said, we want him. And then they began to chant for me like a football player, like Magic Johnson or Michael Jordan. We want Cameron. We want Cameron. We want Cameron. And, man, I could feel the blood freeze in my body.
It's dark now, ain't it?
Oh, yeah. Just as if I could... Oh, it's around 9 o'clock at night now.
What's lighting the outside?
The hole. The city had just installed some new street lights.
Uh-huh.
And, man, it was just as bright as day out there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just as bright as day.
It's August the 7th. It's 9 o'clock at night.
1930. At 9 o'clock at night.
And they shouting, we want Cameron. We want
Cameron. That mob turned around, came back up there, and this one dude had this cone hat on, this Ku Klux Klan hat. His face was bare, and he had a submachine gun, a Thompson submachine gun. Seemed like everybody had a Thompson machine gun in those days except black folks.
Today, too.
All the Capone gang and the Detroit mm-hmm. Purple gang and all the white folks seemed to have everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in with that machine gun. And he said, all you niggas get over on this side of the jail. And he made the white guys get on the other side. And then he said, Cameron's in here, and said, we want him. He said, if we don't get him, he said, we're going to hang every so-and-so one of you damn niggas. Man, he was cussing us out going and coming. Now, I was standing with a bunch of men, about 10 or 12 of those 30 blacks was in there, and they wanted to fight. Man, if they'd had something to fight with, they'd have went down swinging.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have none but bare behinds.
Mm-hmm.
And they stood there and looked at those mobsters in a very defiant way. One of the mobsters hit one of them in the mouth and knocked him down and treated him pretty rough. And finally, after pleading with us to tell who Cameron was, the leader of the mob said, if you don't tell us who he is, we're going to take every goddamn one of you out here and lynch you.
But the brothers wasn't telling.
No, they wasn't telling.
Yeah.
The ones that I was with.
Yeah.
But those other 20, Man, they broke rank and fell out on their hands and knees and started crawling around on the floor. Said, Mr. White Folks, please don't let us. We ain't nothing but a bunch of poor niggas in here with train riding. We ain't done nothing. We don't know that boy. Yeah, Mr. White Folks, honestly, ain't. Please don't hang us. Man, it was going on. It was a bedlam in there.
Yes, sir.
Had to see it to believe it.
Yes, sir. No, I believe it.
When I see it now, I think of how deeply they ground us into the dirt.
Yes, sir.
Put that slave mentality in us and the paralyzing fear of the white man.
Yes, sir.
And I said, Lord, have mercy. So what happened was, when they said, take these niggas out and lynch them, this other 16-year-old boy's father, broken in spirit and mind and body and everything else you can think of, he said, no, Mr. White Folks, please don't take us out of here and lynch us. And then he fell down on his hands and knees and started kissing the white man's hands and hugging his pant legs, you know, like a dog, glad to see his master when he come back home. Hmm. And all of them was down there just crying and hollering. I mean, sobbing at the mouth and everything else.
Hmm.
Please don't hang us, Mr. White Folks. We ain't nothing but a bunch of poor niggas in there for train riding. So he looked up and he pointed his finger at me where I was standing and said, there he is. And when he said that, those on the ground that had been saying that I wasn't there, they said, yes, sir, mister, that's him. It was not us. And then all hell broke out. Man, they rushed in and grabbed me, and they beat me everywhere but loose. They drug me down out of the cell block, down the stairs, out into the street. When I got out in the street, the crowd came to life. And the police, instead of making the street safe for people to walk, they were clearing the path through the mob so they could get me up to the tree where Tom and Abe was hanging.
Mm-hmm.
And then, on the way up there, I'm looking at the people that they beat me and telling them, I don't deserve this. I haven't done nothing to deserve this. And all I could see was just eyes staring at me.
Like devils or demons or something?
Well, I don't know what you would call it. But they were staring at me. They were eyes and human heads just staring at me. Wow. Nobody offered to help me or nothing. I kept pleading for help, for mercy. And little kids was trying to get to me, to scratch me, and they were spitting at me. And some of the ones that the mobsters holding me caught spit in their face as much as I did.
Hmm. But they were still carrying you.
So what happened was, they got me up to the tree where Tom and Abe were standing, and there I was with death on both sides of me. And they were ready to hang me when I looked up to heaven, because my mother had always told us kids, always pray to God.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked up to heaven, and I said, Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins. And then I was glad to be leaving a bunch of people who were so damn deceitful, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of welcomed death in a way.
Yeah.
I had resigned myself to it.
Yeah.
And then when I said that, Lord, forgive me, a voice came out from somewhere and said, take this boy back. He had nothing to do with any killing. And believe it or not, man, that mob released me. And when that voice said that, you know, it seemed like I was in a room, a big room, where a photographer had some negative strips about a foot wide and about 10 or 12 feet long hanging from the walls, you know, like he's drying out the negatives or something. And I could look at the negatives and I couldn't see whether the people were white or black, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it seemed like I just stood still for an eternity. And then all at once, everything came back to normal, and that's when they took the rope off my neck and let me stagger back to the jail. Then when I got back to the jail, the sheriff out there saying, I'm going to try to get you out of here for safekeeping, boy.
Mm.
Hell, it was too late for that.
Oh, man.
Knew since early that morning, because white people and black folks had been calling him all morning, telling him to get us out of there.
Mm-hmm.
No, them decent white folks didn't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me down in the basement and had one of his deputies to put me in the car, and they sped away from there with the tires squealing, like they was telling the mob something was happening, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't know where they'd take me. They took me over to Huntington, Indiana, about 19, 20 miles away from Marion. And going into Huntington, they had put me down on the floor of this car and covered me with the floor mat.
Mm-hmm.
So on the way over to Huntington, they were saying, man, they sure beat the hell out of that one nigga, didn't they? Then they pulled the mat off of me and said, were you scared, nigga? Well, hell yes, I was scared. But I didn't tell them.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. I just looked at him. Mm-hmm. My blood was again at the boil. I said to myself, if I could just get out of here and get me a white man or a woman or a child or anything and kill them, it would be the best thing in the world I could do. I began to build up a hatred for white people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we rode on a little further, and one of them said they ran a crowbar through that one boy a couple of times, didn't they? And said, nigga, what kind of beat did they give you? You know, and hey, I'm all black and blue with bruises, but thank God wasn't no bones broken or nothing like that. My eyes weren't punched out. I still had my genitals and everything. What happened was they drove on to this little place, a little cottage, a little house, man, with three cells in it on each side of the cell block. On one side where there were three cells, there was a young white girl there, and she was about 18 and 19 years old, a pretty thing. And she had gone out of her mind. She didn't know nothing, man.
Mm-hmm.
We're just sitting there staring into space. And you can believe it or not, you know, I felt sorry for that young girl.
Is that human?
Just get out of here and get me a white man or a woman or a child or anything and kill them. It would be the best thing in the world I could do. I began to build up a hatred for white people, you know. And we rode on a little further, and one of them said they ran a crowbar through that one boy a couple of times, didn't they? And said, nigga, what kind of beat did they give you? You know, and hey, I'm all black and blue with bruises, but thank God wasn't no bones broken or nothing like that. My eyes weren't punched out. I still had my genitals and everything. What happened was they drove on to this little place, a little cottage. A little house, man, with three cells in it on each side of the cell block. On one side where there were three cells, there was a young white girl there, and she was about 18 and 19 years old, a pretty thing. And she had gone out of her mind. She didn't know nothing, man. We're just sitting there staring into space. And you can believe it or not, you know, I felt sorry for that young girl.
It's that humanity, brother.
Out to her.
That's that humanity, brother.
I guess it was.
Yeah, that's why we endured.
When I think about it now, I you see, you have to understand, things like that happen to people. I don't know why, but there was an old man on the other side in three cells over there, on the other side where there were three cells.
Yes, sir.
There was an old man there, a white-haired man. That man's hair was white as snow. And he said, son, said, I heard the police talking to the turnkey that, when they brought you in here, and said, I had an argument with my son. He said, we knew here in Huntington there's going to be a lynching since early this morning in Marion. And he said, I pleaded with my son not to go over there. He said, maybe my son was the one that put that rope around your neck. And he was just looking at me. He had the kindest eyes I'd ever seen in a man. You know, the eyes of a saint.
Brother Cameron.
Yes.
Who was the voice that said, don't lynch
him? Oh, no, I think it was from heaven. That's all I can say.
Does anybody there remember the voice?
Oh, years later when I came back, they said, we didn't hear the voice, you were just lucky. But the thing of it is...
Was it a man or woman's voice?
Woman's voice. But be that as it was...
Yes, sir.
I'm standing there looking at this man in the eyes. He's telling me how sorry he is for what his people had done to my people. And he wondered, when was people going to ever grow up and stop doing those mean things? I didn't ask him at all, but I'm sure he received an empathy from me when he looked into my eyes. And I'm pacing the floor, man, because if that mob would come over there and Marion, all from Marion, all they had to do was lean against that building, and they could have fell in, you know. Because that was a brick building they broke into over in Marion. This was just a little cottage.
You ain't been asleep still.
No, I ain't been sleeping still. So I'm pacing the floor all night long. Every time cars come by, the headlights flash up through the jail window, you know, and I'm wondering if it's a mob from Marion coming over. And holy smokes, that morning early, they get us out of there, and it's chilly in the morning, you know, that August morning, yes. August the 8th.
Yes, sir. Yep.
It was on a Friday.
August the 8th, 1930.
Yeah, August 8th, 1930. About 5:30, 6 o'clock, they got me up and said, we're going back to Marion, nigga. I thought that was strange because Marion was a place I wanted to be from, not to go back to.
Yes, sir.
Huh?
Yes, sir.
What happened was They went on back to Marion, and they didn't insult me at all on the way over there. But, man, on the way to Huntington, they had called me everything but a child of God.
Mm-hmm.
So when they get back to Marion, instead of staying on the highway and going on down to the Indiana State Reformatory for safekeeping, they cut through the city of Marion, and when they got in there, the newspaper vendors was hawking, two Negroes in here last night, extra, extra, extra. And they said, bring me a paper, boy. So they brought a paper, and then they pulled a mat back and showed me the picture of Tommy and Abe on the front page of the paper hanging on the tree.
Hmm.
And then they said, look at that, nigga, how you like that?
Brother Cameron?
Yes.
Can we take a short break?
Yes.
And we're going to come back, and we're going to, this is heavy. This is really heavy. Brother James Cameron's on the telephones with us tonight from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, recounting events that took place on August the 6th, 7th, and 8th, 1930, when the brother was almost lynched. He's lived to tell that story, and he's also lived to fight back. We'll be talking with Brother Cameron in a little bit, so y'all don't go nowhere, because I know, like me, you really want to hear the rest.
No.